The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us to round out the week that was. Follow us at danproftshow.com. That's the website where you can find podcasts of our program. You can also get podcasts at iTunes and Spotify and on social media at Dan Proft Show. We begin on this program with a Peggy Noonan piece in the Wall Street Journal that I thought is consistent with sort of the growing consensus in the country that we have to find a way to live with this thing, manage it the best we can, and muddle through, writes Noonan. Meanwhile, she writes, there's something that should stop, the class element in the public debate. It's been there the whole time, but it's getting worse, and few in public life are acting as if they're sensitive to it. There's a class divide between those who are hardline on lockdowns and those who are pushing back. The overclass, as Peggy Noonan calls it, borrowing from Michael Lind in his excellent new book, The New Class War. We've had him on the show. We've talked about the book. The overclass. The overclass has been in charge since the pandemic began. Scientists, doctors, political figures, consultants, calling the shots for the average people. But personally, they have less skin in the game. The National Institutes of Health scientists won't lose his livelihood over what's happened. Neither will the midday anchor. Zing. I've called this divide the protected versus the unprotected. There is an aspect of it that is not much discussed, but bears on current arguments. How you have experienced life has a lot to do with how you experience the pandemic and its strictures. Here's a generalization based on a lifetime of experience and observation, Noonan continued. The working class people who are pushing back have had harder lives than those now determining their fate. Such a key point. They haven't had familiar economic ease. No one sent them to Yale. They often come from considerable family dysfunction. This has left them tougher or harder. You choose the word. And she goes on to document some of the more egregious examples of the overclass stereotype, some of the more disdainful and dismissive and frankly disgusting comments from governors, lockdown and bust governors in this country, like Pennsylvania's Tom Wolf, Michigan's Eva Perón of East Lansing, Gretchen Whitmer. And I would add to Peggy's list, my home state governor, J.B. Pritzker, King J.B. of House Pritzker, as I term him. She reminds us what Tom Wolf said in a press briefing, calling those opposed to a shutdown cowards, telling local officials who, in his words, cave into this coronavirus, they will pay a price in state funding. Those folks are choosing to desert in the face of the enemy in the middle of a war, said Tom Wolf of local officials opposed to his draconian shutdown, accusing them of treason. Of course, the Eva Perón of East Lansing, Michigan, called the reopen rally goers racist and misogynistic. Similar insinuations were made of similar protesters, rally goers in Illinois by Governor Pritzker. Peggy Noonan summarizes, when you are reasonable with people and show them respect, they will want to respond in kind. But when they feel those calling the shots are being disrespectful, they will push back hard and rebel even in ways that hurt them. There is no time to make our divisions worse. The pandemic is a story not only about our health, but also our humanity. Indeed. And when you compel the unification of opinion, you achieve only the unanimity of the graveyard, as Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson famously observed. And you treat people who've always played by the rules, who are operate in good faith, who are considerate as the enemy. Let me give you an example. Beth George runs and has for 31 years a little resort called White Pines in a community about 100 miles west of Chicago in Illinois. She made an announcement on Facebook this week about the fate of the White Pines Resort.
I'm going to be one of the statistics that don't make it. I'm filing for bankruptcy and having to close down. I'm smart enough to know that the numbers just won't work for being able to reopen. I followed the rules. I believed in doing flattening the curve and closing down to save lives, to have enough hospital beds and ventilators. And then everything started to change, and I started hearing the rules of what could happen or what will happen if and when we can ever reopen, and the numbers won't work for my business. My business is based on volume. I do weddings, Sunday buffets, banquets, graduation parties, retreats, dinner theater, and all those require and are based on numbers that are over 50 people. And when Governor Pritzker announced the phases for opening, there won't be people able to gather in 50 or more until there's a vaccine.
Until there's a vaccine, which, of course, as we know on this show, because we're rooted in science and likely outcomes based on knowledge that we have. Like, for example, there's never been a vaccine developed for a coronavirus. Beth George continued.
I can't be open. I've worked my business. I'm the face of my business. I meet with the brides. I'm the hostess on holidays in my restaurant. I introduce the dinner theater. I poured my heart and soul into this place, and I'm a mess trying to say that it won't be there anymore. All the friends and the family and the staff, it's breaking my heart to have to say this, and I promised myself I wasn't going to cry, that I could do this and get through it.
But Beth George, per these politicians that Peggy Nunes was referencing in some of their intemperate comments, and what I know from the politicians in Illinois as a lifelong resident, Beth George is the enemy. She's the villain in the story. She's the one who's selfish. They're not. Beth George's business is not essential and was deemed so by those whose salaries and benefits and job security are essential, also deemed so by them. Something else Beth George said in her Facebook post was really announcing a sale that she's doing of all of her assets in order to pay back those whose deposits she took for the event she normally has during the warm weather months in Illinois. Something else she said about her comfort level with asking questions about the balance and the fairness of the policies being instituted in Illinois, which are similar to many other states that traffic in the arbitrary and the capricious, including just north of us, the Wisconsin Supreme Court this week. We just talked about Michigan. Something else that Beth George said worth taking note of.
My freedom of speech has been silenced. Throughout this, I wanted to say, how is it possible that the person that has a business right across the street from me with cabins can be open, but I can't? I have the same business. How is it that opening at 25% occupancy could ever work? No one can make money when you can only have 25% of the people normally coming in there.
Sure, but what does a trust fund kid like J.B. Pritzker care about that? What are those imperious politicians who are interested only in the extension of their power? What is their concern about whether you can make a go of it or not? You're inconsequential. You're non-essential. Open Table survey out today projecting 1 in 4 restaurants may never come back, even despite the fact that you've got a majority of states moving into reopening, some more quickly than others, of course. But what she said about, she can't ask these questions, raise the specter of hypocrisy and capriciousness, because the shame mobsters come from her, like they come from others. You see, the rest of the self-styled betters in politics, media, academia, the rent-seeking business sector, they are beyond reproach because every breath they take and every move they make is to save lives. So we're told, and then that's rinsed and repeated by their allied betters in the media. But Beth George and those like her should be subjected to vile name-calling and absurd characterizations by the same media types if they dare challenge shame mobsters on the merits. The end result?
I will miss everyone terribly. I'm a survivor, so I'm going to make it. I'm just not going to make it at White Pines. Thank you for your time.
Illinois, like other states governed by Democrat socialist lockdown and bust politicians, is a very sick state in ways that have nothing to do with COVID-19.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Building on the conversation we were having before the break about Beth George, the owner of the White Pines Resort in Illinois. Another perspective from a small business person, a little bit more pointed than Beth George, but just as poignant in a different way. David Portnoy is the founder of Barstool Sports, popular sports and pop culture website. And he took to the internet yesterday to express his dismay at the moving of the goalposts and the shutdown policies generally.
When did this become flatten the curve, flatten the curve, flatten the curve to we have to find a cure or everyone's going to die? Like Fauci. Seems like a nice enough dude. I've always been like, oh, no agenda. Looks like he could be maybe the grandfather in Wedding Crashers. Gets in front of the Senate. He's like, we reopen the country too quick. Everyone's dead. Where'd that come from? And the L.A. mayor. We're not opening the city till we find a cure? What? Find a cure? Who says we're going to find a cure? We haven't found a cure to cancer. It took AIDS 20 years or whatever. Do we even have a cure? So the economy just shut down? All we've heard forever, flatten the curve, flatten the curve, make sure there's hospital beds. We're there. Now all of a sudden it's like a 180. This is like taking a cross-country flight, 6 hours. They tell you flight 6 hours. 5 hours and a half go by. They get on the intercom like, oh, just kidding. We have another 10 hours. You can't do that. People have been mentally preparing. We're doing what you ask. We've done exactly what you said. Now you're changing the rules. And some states are open, some close. LA shutting down, New York shutting down, Arizona's opening, Florida's opening. Seems along political lines. What is going on?
Right. And the rules changes are not driven by, well, wait a second. We didn't know certain things at the beginning. We've learned certain things. And now in order to adopt our strategy to the reality on the ground, we need these draconian edicts. We issue these draconian edicts because we need these policies followed meticulously in order to save lives and then get reopened more quickly. I mean, they suggest that, the lockdown and bust politicians, but they don't prove it. They don't provide a lot of evidence in support of it, thus the problem. Not to mention, they provide almost no humility. They just keep repeating the same thing they've repeated since the beginning. We are men and women of science and data. We are men and women of science and data. Out of an abundance of caution, we are doing this. And out of abundance of caution, we are taking that, whether it's your individual rights or your private property. Well, that gets old real quick when all you have are refrigerator magnet cliches, and those cliches remain even when the underlying conditions change. So rather than rely on politicians, Portnoy says, you know, if the question was put to him, take my chances with COVID-19 versus lose 20 years of my work in creating a business.
You're going to give these people a choice? If you told me Because of Corona, I lost Barstool. I had to go get a 9-to-5 and start f***ing over. I'd rather die of Corona, seriously. Or at least take my chances. I'm not saying everybody would do that. I would. But if I've dedicated 20 years of my life, I don't want to start over. I'll f***ing deal with Corona. You can't just make everybody stay inside and basically start over. It's insane. Like, what the f*** do they think is going to happen?
Particularly David Portnoy, who I think is in his early 40s. I don't know if he has any comorbidities or not, but would have about a 99.5 to 99.9 chance of surviving coronavirus if he was to be infected. You know, risk in context, right? Not take my chances with Corona. This again, when you have to sort of cook the numbers and scaremonger rather than be specific to offer an honest risk assessment, it sort of undermines your credibility. And the statement I'm talking about is the one you hear from certain public health officials attached to certain politicians in certain states that suggests, without saying explicitly, everybody has equal chance of infection and serious health consequences, if not death. And of course, we know that's not true. And in point of fact, it also never made sense to suggest that what was happening in New York City could just as easily be happening in Cheyenne, Wyoming, or anywhere else in the country. Norbert Michael over at Heritage Foundation has been tracking some of the data, the lethality data. 30 counties in the country are home to 48% of the total cases and 55% of the total deaths. 30 counties representing 15% of the total U.S. population. There are nearly 2,000 counties also representing 15% of the U.S. population with one or fewer deaths. They represent 3% of the total cases and 6% of the total deaths. 0.6% of the total deaths. So 30 counties, 15% of the total population. They have 48% of the cases and 55% of the deaths. 2,000 counties, 15% of the population. 3% of the cases, less than 1% of the deaths. And you're saying we should treat those two-thirds of the nation's counties, 2,000 counties, the same way we treat the 30 counties where we have a preponderance of the total cases and a majority of the total deaths. Which is what they've been saying, and which is why they've lost legitimacy. Which is why I'm, you know, squarely in the David Portnoy camp. I'll tell you what, rather than rely on these politicians and watch them take, you know, sort of methodically and inexorably take my business and the quality of my life away, I'm going to take my chances. Also, still being rational, still using my common sense, still taking the guidelines that have been promulgated by experts in the space to heart, and then I'm going to take my chances. The idea that any politician has my back, that's my backstop in life. What a governor or a mayor has to say about this, that's the side on which I want to err based on a assessment of the behavior to this point, the decision making, as well as the knowledge we share, particularly the knowledge we all share as laymen. And most of those in public office are laymen on this topic of infectious disease, just as you and most of our listeners are, which is why we try to get broad perspectives from economists and epidemiologists and infectious disease experts and others in the medical space, as across the range of educators in terms of the impact on learning, criminologists in terms of how we should rethink incarceration. I mean, the broad range, the rich tapestry of human existence in a free society, rather than just putting all our eggs in one politician's basket, repeating one perspective from one or two experts that reinforce that politician's desire to exercise more control over people's lives. Yeah, put me squarely in the David Portnoy camp.
We built this city on rock and roll. We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. We built this city. We built this city on rock.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. It's been another difficult week, both in terms of deaths and illnesses, as well as detrimental economic impacts of lockdown policies. We need somebody to encapsulate it for us, to summarize it at a macro, metaphysical level. I can't think of anybody better than former Vice President Joe Biden on PBS offering this.
This is not a moment for excuses or deflections or blame game. We're in the middle of a pandemic that had cost us more than 85,000 jobs as of today, lives of millions of people, millions of jobs, you know, and we're in a position where, you know, we just got new unemployment insurance this morning, numbers, 36.5 million claims since this crisis began.
Yeah, there he started to sort of right-size jobs versus lives and what the numbers were. Look, I'm not saying that President Trump is the most precise orator I've ever heard, but Joe Biden really seems to have difficulty maintaining the plot here. For more on this, pleased to be joined again by Brian Kilmeade, co-host Fox News Channel's morning show, Fox and Friends, of course you know, host of the Daily National Radio Show, The Brian Kilmeade Show, and the New York Times bestselling author of Sam Houston and the Alamo Avengers, The Texas Victory That Changed American History, which is now, as of May 12th, now available in paperback. Brian Kilmeade, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. It's just amazing. As bad as this pandemic is, if you're trying to run for president, in Joe Biden's case, it's great for him because can you imagine him every day doing two or three events a day? The amount of missteps, you know, in our business especially, you say, wow, I'd like to get that sentence back.
Right.
But he
right.
has to get every sentence back.
Yes, right. There's misstatements and then there are his wild misunderstandings. And that was one of the lighter moments for Joe Biden this week compared to his answers about what he knew about the Flynn counterintelligence investigation and what he even understands about what an investigation is versus a prosecution. But with respect to Biden, it is interesting because as much criticism has been heaped on Trump, here we go again, maybe not as Teflon as Ronald Reagan was, but a CNN poll this week finds Trump plus 7 points in the all-important battleground states.
Yeah, and that's why CNN doesn't run their poll.
Right, exactly.
Because they don't want to run it, because it makes him look terrible. Remember that he's the worst president ever. You know, I timed it one time because the pandemic, there's so many different story angles. You know it. I mean, there's what's happening with business. What about the unemployed? What about how people teaching their kids at home? What about the college student? There's so many different stories. They cannot go 5 minutes without linking something bad to Trump. I mean, it's impossible to blame him for the amount of things they blame him for, but they do. And they bring every guest to Trump. It could be an 8-year-old and talking about having their mom become their teacher on Zoom, whatever it is. And it still goes back to Trump, and it's still not working.
Speaking of 8-year-olds, well, she's a little bit older. How about featuring Greta Thunberg on a panel about the pandemic? I suppose that was because, you know, Sanjay Gupta and Kathleen Sebelius were not big enough draws to get any advertisers for that town hall.
Well, Anderson Cooper defended it, so that makes much sense. She did talk about the Amazon, so that's worth it. I don't get why people want to destroy the global energy source because of a 17-year-old Nordic woman, girl. I don't really like talking about kids in any type of negative way, but I'm just amazed that CNN says she belongs as a panelist. It's just incredible. She's an interesting for a kid, obviously, but my goodness, I don't want her coming up with my energy initiatives.
Well, also, too, I mean, just that, like, Sanjay Gupta is a medical doctor, respected physician, a former CDC director, former HHS director. I mean, the idea that she belongs on that panel, it's just sort of remarkable.
Nuts.
I mean, I as a professional, I just wouldn't participate, not because I want to be critical of her, just because, I mean, come on, what are you doing? You it's the organizer who has the problem, not Greta Thunberg or any of the panelists.
Yeah, and I just think that it seems like those networks are invested in shelter in place. So whatever you do, don't go out. Whatever you do, don't open up that restaurant. Remember, the governor of Georgia was the worst person in the world. And now that Georgia is going well, the numbers are still going down. You don't even hear that mentioned, Brian Kemp. Does anyone talk about even Anthony Fauci pointing out the success of South Carolina and now Florida as we open up? And as Texas is going so quick, even some liberal mayors are pushing back for their governor who's moving so quick because we can't do this anymore. It should all, our stories should all be, what does it take to reopen responsibly? That's what it should be.
That's where the burgeoning consensus is. And just talking about the governors, too, and the idea that Andrew Cuomo, who made perhaps the most catastrophic decision of any governor during this pandemic, which is the reintroduction of infected nursing home patients into nursing homes, the idea that he is still touted as America's governor effectively is just remarkable to me.
He just had a press conference, which is going to push everything back about 2 weeks outside five innocuous counties in the very rural counties in New York. And I think things are going to get a little tough for him. And some of the criteria he has out there is just not practical.
We'll pick up right there. I want to pick up on the point you made about the burgeoning consensus on a rational reopening. More with Brian Kilmeade, the co-host of Fox and Friends, and a New York Times bestselling author of Sam Houston and the Alamo Avengers, The Texas Victory That Changed American History, now available in paperback. Brian Kilmeade, more with him right after this.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Brian Kilmeade. He is, of course, the co-host of Fox News Channel's Fox and Friends, host of the Daily National Radio Show, The Brian Kilmeade Show. New York Times bestselling author of Sam Houston and the Alamo Avengers, The Texas Victory That Changed American History, which is now available in paperback. You want to pick that up, and we'll talk about that in a second. Just to the point you were making before the break, Brian, about the consensus where the conversation really is in this country, whether certain politicians want it to be or not, is rational reopening. And I point to even a New York Times op-ed from Marty Makary, who is a professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins, and said in February, I told my family to hunker down for 3 months and I call for a national shutdown. But he writes, as circumstances have evolved, so has my thinking. We've survived the surge in hospitalized cases and suffered immense economic trauma. The full lockdown made sense weeks ago, but the situation isn't changing. More data on the virus are now available to inform our next steps. The choice before us isn't to fully lock down or to totally reopen. It is essentially, he goes on to describe, a phased reopening like you see states doing, states that are headed up by Republicans like DeSantis in Florida and Kemp in Georgia, as well as Democrats like Jared Polis in Colorado.
Yeah, and I spoke to him, too, on my radio show, and it's true. And by the way, 3 months is gone. You know, so we were in May, and he said that in February. So we did it. The economic strife is much beyond anyone's expectations, and the president's going to try to put this thing back together again, but he can't do it if certain Democratic mayors are going to say, not yet. Well, let's wait till June. And the mayor of Los Angeles, not until August. And now we need a cure, better known as a vaccine. My goodness, what the hell are you talking about? Are you crazy? And meanwhile, I'm getting these words now that we're allowed to go to the beaches on Long Island. Wow, fantastic. But there's going to be strict restrictions. Do you believe this country? Strict restrictions. Go to the beach, open air, keep your distance. That's the restriction. If now they're going to start with the no sunbathing, don't sit on benches, don't linger, don't bring food. So here we go again. Way overreaching. That's how they're going to write about this period.
Well, right. And of course, we're still just starting to get a handle on the brunt of the economic damage that will be inflicted across the populace. I mean, 36 million people over the last 7 weeks filing first time unemployment benefits is just a stunning number. Retail sales down 16% in April, an all time record. Those are stunning numbers.
Yeah, we lost 6% of our GDP. I mean, we were trying to get 3 and 4% this quarter. That's where we were heading. So this is unbelievable. I mean, just, you know, the comparisons. What I just think now is our shows should be about effectively marshaling innovation and determination in order to effectively open up all these businesses and our country, living with it while the scientists work hard on it. Just live with it. What do we have to do? What personal responsibilities do we have to make in order to make this happen? It is no longer, I'm going to stay home. I don't want to see any street signs and electronic warnings that show courage, stay home. No. I mean, we had a mayor a couple of weeks ago who actually said, I know it's nice out, go out for a little while, but go right back in. Are you kidding me? It's more dangerous in the house, and who the hell are you to tell me to go back in? And then we spot him across town, de Blasio, in a park in Brooklyn, walking with his wife. I mean, these people think we're idiots.
Well, and the other part of this, too, as you're suggesting, needs to be pushed back against the idea that recovery comes through the public sector, which is being advanced by de Blasio and Pelosi and Schumer. The idea that it's all about federal spending on state and local governments rather than opening up and allowing the productive sector to get back to producing.
Yeah, I mean, the innovation that is coming out now, I'm looking at the story out of Syracuse where they have this drone, and this drone is going to be able to go to open-air stadiums and essentially sterilize the whole thing if you want. I could see go to a baseball game or a doubleheader, everyone leaves, in comes a couple of drones, and they take care of the whole stadium. And people are bidding on this now. So this is the type of innovation we need. You just leave it to the public sector, and then all of a sudden there's going to be innovation. Like, security was big after 9/11. If you had security and you had a background, man, we need you in schools, we need you at theaters, we need you in the mall. Now, if you have a sterilization company or you know of an effective way to do it for individuals or for buildings, you are going to be rolling in money.
I want to revisit your book because, I mean, the storyline couldn't be more timely in a sense, the idea of a fight for independence. All the things we were just discussing, but your book about Sam Houston and the Alamo Avengers, the Texas victory that changed American history, again, now available in paperback. Just again, reframe your angle here in terms of the Alamo and Sam Houston's paving the way for westward expansion for America.
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do and what I've been doing with the books is, we had a president that could not answer the question, is America an exceptional nation? And without digesting propaganda, I went back to prove it. And I'm not saying we're perfect, but the things that have happened in our past are so worthy to learn and so relevant today. So when people explain to you, whether you travel abroad or you meet an American detractor in America, so you can say, cite a series of events that happened in our past that outline who we are, one of which was Sam Houston, the Alamo Avengers. And, in a time in which the world more than ever back then was if your parents weren't born into wealth, you didn't have it. And if you didn't have a great job, you're not going to get it. We were a country where if you work hard and you are innovative enough, you could be successful. One was Andrew Jackson, example of that. The guy was an orphan at 13, president of the United States twice, major general, lawyer, congressman. And then you have Sam Houston, loses his dad at a young age, bad farmer, used to cut out of school, used to read on his own, bad clerk. And this guy ends up being a war hero, the first president of Texas, a senator from Texas, two-term governor of Texas, and a governor of Tennessee, the only one to be governor of two separate states in American history. So I just thought telling that story and how the Texas Revolution was won was worth the other 49 states to learn. In Texas, they get it. But it's up to them to understand, up to the world to understand now, the other 49 states contributed to it.
He is Brian Kilmeade, co-host of Fox News' Fox and Friends, host of the Daily National Radio Show, The Brian Kilmeade Show, New York Times bestselling author of the book we were just discussing, Sam Houston and the Alamo Avengers, The Texas Victory That Changed American History. Pick it up now, available in paperback. Brian Kilmeade, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, man. Have a great weekend.
You too. Take care.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. I shouldn't be surprised by this. I'm not terribly surprised by this, but it's worth remarking upon. The ACLU has come out against due process. The American Civil Liberties Union, which, by the way, is nowhere to be found during the COVID-19 pandemic and the responses from various states regarding constitutional rights, but I digress. They've come out against due process in a quasi-criminal proceeding. I'm talking about a lawsuit they filed against Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos's revised federal guidelines on how sexual assault allegations should be handled both on college as well as K through 12 campuses. The changes, which institute the norms of our justice system into these tribunals on K through 12 and college campuses, the due process norms, the ACLU claims would inflict significant harm, quote unquote, on victims and dramatically undermine their civil rights. Presumption of innocence, due process, undermines the system. It doesn't protect everybody's rights, both the accuser and the accused. Remember, this is the Joe Biden response upon the promulgation of these rules last week was to say that one of the first things I do as president when I take office in January is to rescind the rules, the new guidelines that Betsy DeVos has put forward. Under the old guidelines, if the Tara Reid allegations against Joe Biden had happened while they were both on a college campus, Joe Biden would be convicted and expelled, or worse. But he's fine with that because he doesn't have to face the consequences. So he's fine imposing this unfair approach to meting out justice on college campuses. By the way, the idea that when you're talking about matters such as sexual assault, you know, harassment is a little bit more unclear, verbal and so forth, in terms of criminality. Sexual assaults, not unclear. Police matters. Why are colleges or much less K through 12 systems adjudicating these matters at all? Refer to police. Stay out of the way. Police and prosecutors, stay out of the way. But nonetheless, in terms of administrative proceedings, I have to repeat this again. Just the American Civil Liberties Union is opposed to due process, is opposed to the norms of our criminal and civil justice systems that they otherwise, I believe, the organization was otherwise organized to defend. The suit claims the new rules, new guidelines, would place a heavier burden on those alleging sexual harassment than on students who allege other forms of harassment. The standard should be uniform. It's not heavier. To the extent that there are burdens that are lower for other forms of harassment, those burdens should be raised to the due process and fairness norms as well when you're including you know, racial or other sorts of harassment. How are you a civil libertarian and you're opposed to due process and erring on the side of protecting the accused? Are we not, I mean, again, normatively speaking here, are we not still a country that says better 1,000 men go free than one guilty man be imprisoned? Apparently not if you're a supporter of the ACLU.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes. Twitter, @DanProft and @DanProftShow. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson weighed in on the unmasking of the unmaskers, the actions taken in the last week by both Attorney General Barr, as well as acting DNI, Richard Grenell, of course, and also about the future in terms of future hearings on these matters.
They are heroes. They are patriots. They're being unfairly attacked right now, mercilessly attacked. And these gentlemen realize that this is a threat to our democracy. It is outrageous.
Really, heroes. Well, over at MSNBC, former CIA Director John Brennan was on with Brian Williams setting up the discussion by saying over at Fox News, they're devoting a lot of time to this narrative about General Flynn and both Operations Crossfire Razor and Crossfire Hurricane, you know, essentially insinuating they're trying to gaslight the public. And here was sort of the big takeaway from John Brennan's comments.
I think our country is in very serious trouble. When you have such blatant political corruption at the highest levels of U.S. government, something I never thought I would see in my lifetime. But when you have an administration, you know, the White House, the Attorney General, the acting head of the intelligence community, all acting in concert to try to advance the personal interests of Mr.
To try to advance the personal interests. I thought he was going to say Obama, but he actually said Trump, of course. But it's remarkable the description that's being used. So the description that's being used of the Obama White House in the closing days of the administration has now just been adopted in toto by those who are facing those accusations. And they're saying they're fighting against the very same thing. Corruption at the highest levels, abuse of power at the highest levels. We fear for our country going forward because of the precedent that the actions by fill in the blank are taking. It's the same narrative in part being argued from opposite sides. It's sort of remarkable to hear. And I think it's confusing and perhaps purposefully confusing. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Brett Baer, host of Fox News Special Report, weekdays, 5 p.m. Chicago time, and also the author of the number one bestseller, 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Brett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. So the competing spin, if you will, and some of this will continue, not just on cable news programs, but in forthcoming Senate hearings, starting with Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, listen, there's a in between here, and that is you can say that the unmasking is not illegal, which it's not. Different officials can do this in administration looking for context to intelligence. The illegal part about it is the leak to the Washington Post.
Right.
And you cannot say that that's not illegal. So that's a problem. And how that all came together and why it came together is really piecing it together. If you're not following the story all the way along, you can easily be told this is no big deal in the big picture. This is no big deal. But then you have to look at the context of what was happening and what that started, which was 2.5 years of Russia collusion, Adam Schiff saying he had definitive evidence. And then you look at the House Intel transcripts and the people who were saying some of that behind closed doors on under oath were saying something completely different, that they had no evidence of this. So I don't think we're going to know the full picture, the full puzzle, until we get John Durham's report, which, you know, they say is a month or 2 months away. And that likely will be the key to the map that gets people to explain exactly what was happening behind the scenes.
I think that's right. Right. Review the emails, text messages, memos, interview witnesses, determine whether the unmasking requests were lawful, because there's an issue there, too, under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You have to have a legitimate basis, which is why there's a provision for it. And to me, that seems like some of the determinations that need to be made by Lindsey Graham's committee. In addition to that, I want to go back to something you just said about the comparison between what Brennan, Clapper, Rice, Power said under oath behind closed doors as to what they were saying on cable news channels for years. To me, that's really important in terms of like trying to cut through a lot of this for people, because, yes, they're both sides are saying the government is weaponized to inflict damage on political opponents. Obama did it, and then the Obama administration officials are saying Trump is doing it. One of the ways to suss out who has credibility on the topic is to compare what they've actually said in public under oath versus not under oath on cable TV. To me, that is the biggest indictment we have right now of the position being advanced by the Brennans and the Clappers and the Comeys of the world.
I agree with you. I mean, listen, you can put all of the statements that they said on the various networks that they are now employed by, and then you can look at the transcript that they said answering questions under oath. They're definitely different. And I think that there are things that were concerning to some intel folks looking at the big picture of what was happening. They didn't have all the information, but at some point they did. At some point they had a good sense that there was no there there, but they continued on. At some point, Robert Mueller knows there's no real case here, but he continues on and continues on past a midterm election where arguably he knows before that. So I think there's, you know, a lot that we don't know about timing. Obviously, you can assume motive, but you have to piece other pieces together before you make the jump. And I think, you know, on the news side of things, that's what we're trying to do, is let both sides say what they're going to say.
Your colleague, Britt Hume, called this the worst fiasco in journalism in terms of the coverage of this story in his 50 years in journalism, which is quite a statement. And I wonder how much you think that this was extended, as you're describing, because of sort of the self-reinforcing loop of the sort of political elites in D.C. and all of these agency heads and powerful people and the coverage they get from the D.C. press corps. And it just becomes, like I said, a self-reinforcing loop that extends beyond all good judgment and evidence.
I think that that's right. The culture of leaking and not getting other sources to check the leak because you believe that this person is in such a high place and is in a position to know that it starts this ball rolling, and suddenly then you have these stories that 27 people were contacted on this. But in reality, it's one guy that's telling you something, and it all turns out to be, you know, falling apart. I think that that statement by Britt was something to see. I mean, he's obviously my mentor and dear friend. He has a lot of experience. And if you look back at the stories from the beginning of the Russia investigation, they're all over the map. And nobody's going back and like cataloging who said what on what cable channel or what paper was out on the limb on this. They're not doing that. And it's kind of like everything's moved on. We deal in chapters in this country, and now we're on the COVID-19 chapter. It's unfortunately a long and painful chapter, but that's where we are.
With respect to Judge Sullivan, it is strange. You've got the recent Supreme Court precedent that seems to be just about on point. But there's some history here with Sullivan, who's been an appointee of both Republican and Democrat administrations. It seems like, I don't know which it is. I don't know if it's he seizes opportunities in high-profile cases to increase his profile, or he has some real deep-seated antagonism toward the Department of Justice because he got cross with Eric Holder, and now he's getting cross with AG Barr.
Yeah, I think it's his MO. It's just rare. Obviously, Michael Flynn talked about that plea and made it in front of Judge Sullivan, so it happened in his court. But again, most judges are presented the cases they deal with party presentation of what is before them, not outside of that realm. So I think that it'll be interesting to see. I think it drags things out. It may drag it out enough where President Trump pardons Michael Flynn. Don't know. It's quite something to watch.
Turning to Nancy Pelosi's introduction of Phase 4, $3 trillion worth of spending that, basically was declared DOA by Mitch McConnell and the White House and so forth, as expected. How do you see that progression? Is a Phase 4, you know, maybe after we get a couple more weeks of reopening and we see how things are going, is that on the table for the White House and for Senate Republicans? And is it still all predicated on the red line that Mitch McConnell drew for indemnifying businesses that are reopening from litigation?
Yeah, that's what he said last night on the show. And he also said, I think that there's a likelihood and an increasing likelihood that there's going to be a Phase 4. They want to see how this phase works out. I think the trigger mechanism, that's what I was trying to get out of McConnell last night, is probably going to be when this next tranche of PPP money dries up. And by all estimates, it looks like June that's going to probably happen. And so I think there's going to be some horse trading. This Nancy Pelosi bill is chock full with a lot of things in 1800 plus pages. And from what I can tell, it is, as the president said, DOA on the Republican side.
He is Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, host of Special Report, 5 p.m. weekdays, Chicago time. Number one bestselling author of 3 Days on the Brink, 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Brett, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Our next guest is a doctor we profiled on the show briefly yesterday per a video that was put together documenting his innovation in the space of primary care. He's a primary care physician. His name is Dr. Timothy Wong. He's out of Pittsburgh. And before we bring him on, just a case study in the approach that he's taken that was profiled in the video to sort of set up the outcomes that he's producing for his patients.
There's no receptionist, nurse, or assistant. Patients sign in on an iPad and wait until he calls them in.
I was at work, put my finger in the mixer, and It's smash.
Brent drove over an hour to get to the eye health clinic.
I've dealt with this kind of injury before. I've paid thousands of dollars, even with my insurance. Last time was actually $750 out of pocket for two stitches.
The most Dr. Wong says he's charged a patient? $55. That doesn't include things like testing or medication. But he works with patients to find affordable options.
And he also makes the point, too, which we'll discuss. But, of course, he's a primary care physician. He's not saying you shouldn't also have a catastrophic health insurance policy, which you should. But we'll get into that now with Dr. Timothy Wong. He is the director of the One Man Eye Health Clinic, as you heard. He's a board-certified family medicine physician specializing in primary care and utilizing technology to improve patient health. Dr. Wong, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So develop a little bit. Give us the backstory on the model that you've created for your patients and the genesis of the model.
Yeah, so I don't think the inspiration came from really one source, but it came from, you know, seeing other healthcare systems, you know, personal experiences, working with insurance companies. And it was just wildly inefficient. At one point, I thought, you know, doing traditional family medicine, I was, you know, kind of a culprit and part of the problem because I was in the system that just wasn't working. And so I thought, you know, what if I could figure out a way to practice medicine that's, you know, healthy for myself, but more efficient for patients as well. And so I kind of combined two models. Direct primary care that doesn't take insurance, and micro practice model where I'm the only employee. I can keep costs low enough that I don't have to charge memberships, and I can charge a low fee per visit.
And it's $35 per visit, right?
Yes. Yep. And so we charge $10 extra for extra problems. So if you have like a cold and diabetes that you wanted to manage at the same visit, it would be $45.
Okay, I'm sure the that's pleasant sticker shock for most people. I'm sure, so how? I mean, if it's 35 or 45 is as the video said, the most you've ever charged anybody is $55 per visit. How is it that you can make that work and still make a living, and yet, as you heard from the one case study in the video, you have hospitals charging 10, 20, 100 times in some cases what you're charging for the same care?
Sure. So I think it's kind of like we're looking at first principles and figuring out what do we really need in primary care. At the end of the day, I think the most important element is the patient and the provider. So do you really need like a billing company to chase you for bills you didn't pay? Do you need healthcare administrators who do quality metrics and, you know, make sure there's no polypharmacy or whatever other thing they're looking at? So I'm cutting out really a lot of the middlemen and making it just super efficient. And I've estimated, you know, once I get the clinic fully mature, you know, I'll make a six-figure salary. I won't make as much as I did, but I'll definitely live comfortably and be much happier.
Yeah, the much happier piece, you sort of reference that in the video that I've referenced, which is sort of the satisfaction you get from your job as compared to what it used to be when you were working at a hospital and the increment you're willing to pay for that job satisfaction.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think the model will generate as much salary as a traditional practice unless, you know, you're just working pretty long hours. But, you know, you do trade that off for things. You pretty much eliminate the worst part of the job, which was mostly paperwork and not really helping patients directly.
And with respect to the paperwork and dealing with big amorphous enterprises, which was worse for you in the traditional practice, government or insurance company? Not that there's a lot of difference between the two anymore.
I think that honestly, the biggest culprit is CMS, because CMS, as you alluded to, is kind of government, but also insurance. And whatever rules that CMS makes, actually private insurances copy. So that's the big problem is, you know, even with, Medicare for all, it seems really good to get access for people, but giving CMS more power would be pretty difficult. They would just make more rules, I'd estimate.
And as you have moved this practice from the traditional one to the iHealth clinic model, I assume you have patients that have come with you, and what do they say in terms of their feedback of receiving your care under the new model versus the old?
I've heard a lot of things. The number one comment I hear is, I can't believe there's no line out the door. And sometimes I don't know how to take it. Like, am I doing something wrong because it's not that? Or, you know, is it just a matter of time? I remember one young lady who I helped, and she exclaimed to her boyfriend on the way out, it was so easy. It was so easy. And it was only $45 because I gave her a dispensed an antibiotic as well. But she was, she was just so surprised how seamless it was and how efficient it can be.
What about with respect to your colleagues who know what you've done and are watching what you're doing? Are you expecting you're going to see those follow your lead?
That's what the overall goal is. I believe in the model. Once we're mature, it's going to be, really self-sustaining like any other decent business. And it has the advantage of not limiting patient populations to small numbers. So it's really promoting access to a lot of people, which is kind of the goal of, Medicare for all. It's really about increasing access. So I've reached out, or actually a few doctors have reached out to me and are interested in the model, but I really hope other doctors eventually do that. And as I get, more funding or capital, I can start going to conventions and do other things. But right now it's kind of organic grassroots kind of thing.
Prove up the model and then replicate it, scale it.
Yeah, exactly.
Dr. Timothy Wong, iHealth Clinic in Pittsburgh, board-certified family medicine physician specializing in primary care and utilizing technology to improve patient health. I'll tweet out at Dan Prof Show the video to give you more background, and as well as contact information for those in the greater Pittsburgh area or who want to impress upon their primary care physician to follow the Dr. Wong model. Dr. Timothy Wong, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what is wrong. Was I unwise?
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Are we seeing the slow and steady and perhaps inevitable consolidation of thought at the hands of both big government and big tech, at the hands of big government working with big tech? There's evidence that the public is still resistant, so they're taking their time. The evidence of the resistance we talked about with Professor Humphreys from Stanford yesterday, a University of Maryland Washington Post survey that finds that two-thirds of Americans either would be unable or unwilling to use a virus alert platform under development by Apple and Google as a joint. And of course, there's still a disposition to free speech and free thought culturally, even while the restriction of free speech and free thought is tolerated in large parts of our country, college campuses, even in a distance learning environment, obviously Hollywood, and on social media platforms. And in fact, this was the thrust of Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla's documentary, No Safe Spaces, wasn't it? And Dennis Prager particularly knows the sting of what he's discussing, considering how his Prager University videos have been censored on YouTube. For more on the topic, as Facebook and Twitter methodically march forward in this direction, despite the criticism, despite offering pay-ons to free speech in congressional committee testimony, pleased to be joined by Khalif Lataru, who's a Real Clear Media Fellow and Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, who's written about Facebook's new evidence-free rating system. Khalif, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. So let's start with your piece at realclearpolitics.com about Facebook's false, quote-unquote, rating system. And you give a very easy-to-follow case study in terms of how an opinion can quickly become false if it's the wrong opinion.
Yeah, you know, it's actually a really interesting story. So last month, Emmy Award-winning journalist Shel Atkinson shared this video on Facebook. You know, she immediately, you know, Facebook sent her this notice saying that, you know, you've shared quote-unquote fake news. We're notifying your followers. You can have all kinds of bad things happen. And when she went there and clicked on the link that says, you know, why is this being deemed fake news? It pointed her to this website, I believe it was Health Feedback, which is this fact-checking site that wasn't actually fact-checking that video at all. It was actually fact-checking a New York Post opinion piece. And what's interesting about this is the actually under Facebook's own rules, it's actually a really interesting story because under Facebook's own rules, A, opinion pieces can't be fact-checked, and B, one of the two fact-checkers that reviewed this and found, declared that these things were false, actually worked at the lab in question. So this video was about, what are the possible origins of the COVID-19 virus? Is it possible that it might have escaped from a lab in Wuhan? And it's interesting because one of the two fact-checkers in her own response says, you know, I've worked at this lab for 2 years, and so I believe that this is false. And it's a really interesting thing that, you know, people involved with surge, we think of fact-checkers as these objective people, on these, you know, essentially objective experts that are, you know, have deep knowledge that are objectively reaching out and looking at things, versus here we have a case of someone actually involved in the story, so to speak, rendering judgment on it. And it's an opinion piece to boot. But yet, despite all of that, this is actually being used in the real world to say, hey, you know, anyone that shares these things, this is fake news, and we're going to notify your followers, your purveyor of fake news. We're going to take potentially all these sanctions against you. So it's this really kind of this, we have this veneer of fact checkers objectively telling us what's true. But when you pull the curtain aside, essentially, you see it's not nearly what they make it out to be.
And it just in terms of how this then is pushed through the system, once it's declared false by the fact checker, then anybody who shares the story, it's also that designation follows their sharing.
Exactly. So what happens with Facebook is they have these partners of fact checking sites all around the world. They have all these different organizations that they've designated as fact checking partners. So what happens then is Facebook or the organization can say, here's a story that we believe needs to be reviewed. Then they have fact checkers. People go through it, and then they cast a judgment on it. And they say it's true, it's false. They have actually a whole bunch of different ratings. They can say it's mostly true, it's mostly false, it's true but needs context. But essentially, what you have then is a fact checker can go in, say this story is false, and from that point forward, anyone that shares that story on Facebook is declared to be a purveyor of fake news.
Well, let's pick it up there when we come back with Khalif Littaru, realclearmedia.com fellow. Want to talk about whether or not the rules for these social media platforms are really, there are no rules. There's just a market position we're trying to drive. More with Khalif Littaru right after this.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're talking about Khalif Littaru. He's a RealClearMedia.com fellow, senior fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. And we're talking about the regulating of content that Facebook and Twitter, the social media, big social media platforms do, particularly in the space of policy and politics. Khalif, let me just start with, before we get to Twitter, because I want to get your view on Twitter's designations now of disputed. But generally speaking, do we have here Facebook and Twitter, Google, YouTube, here are our rules, you know, in defense of quality content and fair play and consistent with the principles of free speech, so long as there's, you know, no appeal to prurient or hateful interests. Those rules are set forward. But then in terms of the actual implementation, the message is simple for the minders, which is we want to eliminate content that we disagree with and we want to drive content that we agree with.
You know, that's what makes these stories so fascinating is on the surface, what the social media companies are doing sounds perfectly fantastic. We're going to get rid of horrible, you know, hate speech. We're going to get rid of falsehoods. We're going to ensure that people see real, you know, high quality, non-hateful information. The problem is, how do you define that? Who defines what's real and what's false? Who defines, I mean, it's sort of very Orwellian 1984 of, you know, what's real and what's false? What's acceptable speech that we're permitted to talk about or acceptable beliefs and what's not acceptable? And what's interesting here is, you know, liberal democracies like the United States, for, you know, we've debated these issues for over the centuries. We've come up with a very expansive, essentially, protection for free speech. Other than a handful of cases, a U.S. citizen is allowed to do a lot of things. What's interesting here is private companies, all of a sudden in the last 10 or 15 years, you know, you have these social media companies that have really stepped forward and said, the government may allow you to say anything you want, but we're going to come up with our own rules for what you're permitted to see and say on our platforms. The average person today, you hear from your elected official, probably through Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, social media. You talk to them oftentimes on social media. You know, our public debates about where we want our country to head occur on social media. So, you know, that the public square that's so crucial to democracy, that's in private hands now with these companies, where tomorrow Mark Zuckerberg can say, hey, you know what? I don't agree with this idea. I don't want people to talk about that. Flip a switch and suddenly it disappears. Like you saw with Facebook banning posts that encourage certain types of reopening protests. Facebook simply said, we're not going to allow people to discuss or organize those here.
Well, right. And of course, the argument would be from the free market side that, hey, look, they built it and you came. So it's their private platform and they're allowed to make the rules for your participation. And I'm somewhat sympathetic to that, but there still are contract rights issues. There are still issues with respect to commercial fraud if you're promulgating rules of use and you're not abiding those rules of use. And that seems to me what we're seeing, where hate speech will soon become statements like I disagree will soon become hate speech. I mean, it is effectively the de facto consolidation of opinion, the enforced unanimity of opinion when it comes to things like, as you were just describing, COVID-19 related policies. And I'll tell you, too, it's not just the fact that we have these rules, but the rules are there are no rules in terms of their application. Also, in terms of their non-application. So, for example, I posted a story on Facebook just to personalize it. It's the first time it's ever happened to me. I posted a story where there was somebody had identified that a California news outlet and a Jacksonville, Florida news outlet used the same picture of people on the beach to essentially push the idea that beaches shouldn't be reopened because people are on the beaches and they're not social distancing. Same picture in California and Florida outlets. And it was, in fact, used on those two outlets. But the dispute from Facebook was that's misleading because there was some sort of technical glitch that resulted in that same picture being used in the Florida story that was used in the California story. But they didn't flag the stories themselves and the technical glitch and provide that context. They just flagged it when somebody else repurposed the story to make a point that the story was misleading. So I'm misleading for posting about it, but the original post isn't misleading. It's that sort of stuff where the standards are applied depending on the perspective being driven that is concerning if people don't understand it and may ultimately be their undoing or provide for what conservatives have talked about for a long time, which is the rise of a competitor in that space that actually is committed to free communication on their platform.
You see, that's actually exactly the point of my piece, and that's actually a fascinating and unfortunately all too common case where, you know, one of the problems these companies, you know, despite the fact that they're literally defining what's true and false for society now, they, you know, there's no transparency into what they do. When they get things wrong, You know, like even like in this particular case, you know, Facebook's own rules say an opinion piece cannot be fact checked, period. And here's a fact checker that took an opinion piece and did it. So he violated
and declared it false. Right.
It took weeks for the New York Post to finally get Facebook to, you know, quietly change the ruling. But even then, you know, Facebook didn't issue a public statement saying, hey, you know, we got this wrong. We apologize. There's no transparency. So when these things go wrong, we have no visibility into that. And we don't even know, like in this particular case, for me as an information scientist, when I see, hey, you know, this is someone associated with the Wuhan lab that's rendering judgment on a story involving that lab, you know, that's just completely antithetical to this whole idea of a neutral,
impartial,
you know,
yeah,
a neutral, independent third party. And, you know, it's just this whole world of, and, you know, again, to your point, well, you know, they're walled gardens, you know, we don't have to use Facebook or Twitter, but you actually almost do today. You know, you think about the president of the United States, you know, President Trump, he's on Twitter. If you want to reach the president of the United States, you have to use Twitter. Yes, you could write a letter and hope it doesn't get lost in the, you know, the White House mail room. Or you can just tweet directly to the president. And that's the problem. These are the platforms that reach almost all of the major members of Congress now. They're on social media. That's how you talk to your elected officials today. You know, local government here in Washington, local government, it's Twitter, it's their Facebook pages. That's where you have to go to even find out, you know, are the roads going to be open tomorrow? You know, it's all social media. So really, government has adapted. Social media is essentially the way we communicate with our government now, so we can't avoid it. And that's that fascinating thing.
And Trump on the center right, Trump is about the only one on Twitter who's too big to be censored, at least for now. He is Khalid Lataru. He's RealClearMedia.com fellow and senior fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Khalid, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
You listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Yeah, another installment of Why Dan Proft is Single. Remember, this is why I'm single from my perspective, not from the female's perspective. I get to have a say too. And this comes from a Dear Prudence advice column at Slate.com, of all places. 5 years ago, I broke up with Amy because she couldn't have children. I felt awful about it. But having a family had always been important to me, and she wasn't interested in adoption or surrogacy right from the start. We just couldn't imagine a future where we were happy, so they broke up. He later ran into Amy at a farmer's market recently. She was 6 months pregnant. We talked for a while, he writes. I congratulated her, and she asked if I was a dad yet. When she found out I wasn't, she said this baby that she was carrying could have been his if he had passed her test. He writes, according to Amy, she'd never been told she was infertile. She just wanted to see if I loved her enough to give up being a dad. So she lied for over 4 months until we broke up, saying that she was infertile. She couldn't have children and didn't want to do adoption or surrogacy. He writes, I can't get over it. I don't know if it's because I'm stuck inside on my own. This is, of course, current, so shutdown words, or what, but it just eats at me. The advice he gets from, you know, one of these daffy advice columnists, it's a beyond a weird thing to do, what Amy did. Of course, you find yourself wondering whether you really ever knew her and having trouble squaring this bizarre, awful, unloving trick with the idea that an otherwise normal person, employee, wife, mother could do something like that. I tell you what, we're in the era of data. So let's just go to the data on this and figure out where Amy fell on the hot versus crazy matrix. And this probably explains it, so that our friend, who shall remain nameless, can get on with things.
Okay, so this is the universal hot crazy matrix. It's everything a young man needs to know about women. I've developed this on my own over 46 years of living on the earth. So above an 8 hot and between about a 7 and a 5 crazy, this is your wife zone, okay? Above the danger zone, above the crazy line, we have the danger zone. This is your redheads, your strippers, anyone named Tiffany.
hairdressers.
This is hairdressers. This is where your car gets keyed, you get a bunny in the pot, your tires get slashed, and you wind up in jail.
So my guess, I don't know Amy, but she probably was in the hairdresser Tiffany zone there in terms of the hot, crazy matrix. And so that probably explains why she played that cruel trick on you, asked you, you know, that question. And the bottom line, you know, sort of the net of it, dude, you dodged a bullet. Yeah, speaking of entertainment, sort of. I want to direct our listeners to, again, check out No Safe Spaces, which is available now to watch for a limited time at nosafespaces.com, talking about the number one political documentary of 2019, produced by the great Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla in advance of the fight for free speech in a free America. For my listeners, for a limited time only, discount code SAVE25 gets you 25% off No Safe Spaces. You can live stream it on demand right now. No Safe Spaces at nosafespaces.com. Save 25 for 25% off.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us at danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes, Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. Yesterday evening, CNN featured a panel discussion on the COVID-19 pandemic that included future chair of the Al Gore Fear Studies Department at Harvard University, Greta Thunberg.
Well, I mean, first of all, we still haven't gotten tested because here you don't get tested unless you're in need of medical help. So of course, I don't know if I've had it, but I isolated myself anyway, and because it is the right thing to do.
I'm a proponent of her isolating herself, actually. It was great to have her there because otherwise nobody would have tuned in to listen to Sanjay Gupta and a couple of other Kathleen Sebelius. Dusting her off, breaking her out of the emergency glass. This is the whole reason they had Greta Thunberg. They didn't get PPP money, so they got to figure out a way to generate revenue somehow. She is an exemplar, though, of leftist thinking. I mean, she has been fully, fully lobotomized with leftism. Our friend over at Spiked Online, Brendan O'Neill, had a good piece on this, too. The perversion of the left's messaging on this. Going back to work is being sent off to die. And that's the same argument that's being made by Democrat socialist politicians here. There's actually campaign slogans, as Brendan O'Neill mentions, pseudo-Marxist at Novara Media. Back to work, catch the virus, save the billionaires. Because for leftists, you know, the market is just a little more than a conspiracy in which the filthy rich kill their employees to make money. Going back to Brendan O'Neill, they're ramping up the culture of fear in a desperate effort to preserve their bizarre, historically unprecedented anti-work outlook as a good and noble thing. Actual facts, like the fact that under 40s have made up 0.75% of the deaths from COVID, don't get so much as a look in. No, keep all workers at home, even the fit, healthy young ones. And the response from the vanguard class there, like here, this is almost verbatim what Ocasio-Cortez said. Owen Jones, who's a columnist for The Guardian. The working class is being ordered to return to their function as generators of revenue. That's how he describes people's desire to go back to work. O'Neill writing, only someone completely removed from the reality and aspirations of working class communities could describe work in such dehumanizing terms. Precisely. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Rupert Dharwal, strategy consultant and policy analyst, former special advisor to the UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer, and author of The Age of Global Warming, A History, as well as Green Tyranny, Exposing the Totalitarian Roots of the Climate Industrial Complex. Rupert, thanks for joining us. I guess, given the books that you've authored, we should let you have a shot at Greta Thunberg before we move on to more heady matters.
I love that intro on Greta. The interesting thing to me, though, is that Greta is Swedish, and as we know. But Sweden is arguably the only country in the Western world that has adopted a scientifically sensible and risk-acknowledged way of dealing with the COVID, which is not to lock down the economy and to let it spread and let its population acquire herd immunity, which apparently Stockholm is well on the way to doing. So Greta Thunberg could have provided a really valuable lesson to the viewers of CNN on the merits of the Swedish way. The fact she didn't says an awful lot about who's running her.
Let's expand this out to Brendan O'Neill's point and the point that others have made. This notion that being ideologically committed to a lockdown is being ideologically committed to the working class.
I find that the lockdown mantra absolutely extraordinary. There's a very powerful piece, not by someone who I normally agree with, and I don't necessarily agree with his reasoning, but Larry Summers, who was Bill Clinton's last Treasury Secretary, wasn't he? But he says the pandemic is a huge historic event and it will lead to an Asian century. Basically, the West will be left in the ditch. And I think that is, sadly, I think that is the case for Western Europe. So, you know, as people grow older, and you can tell when you're old and you suffer ill health, you get a bout of ill health. You never recover the way you were before. And if you look at Europe, after the big recession of 2008, 2009, Europe didn't really recover. It's basically been flatlining. And I'm afraid after what we're experiencing now, I think it will just be a slump. Whereas in America, you have a president who, well, he's 73, but his vigor and energy and his desire to keep his belief that the future is more important than the present. I think America will pull itself out of the COVID slump. But I fear for Europe. I think Europe's going to just turn into a series of zombie economies.
Well, it'll be interesting because you may have it be quite uneven. You mentioned Sweden as compared to perhaps some other Western European countries, and perhaps the same in the United States. You're going to have states that are growing in population and are sensible with respect to fiscal policy that are attracting, which is why they're growing in population. You know, they will recover and be robust again. The Texases and the Floridas of the world, the Illinois and the New Yorks and the Californias, maybe less so.
I think that's the advantage of a federal system, that you can see what works and what is crazy. And the other country one should mention that seems in Western Europe that seems to be getting it right is Switzerland, which is removing its lockdown. So I've made a generalization, but I should say Britain is one of the worst. The fear that's induced in the population, they don't want the lockdown eased up at all. Vast majorities there think the lockdown restrictions should be harsher. And there's this thing about, you know, you can't risk children going back to school, even though children not only don't get COVID, but don't transmit it. And so this is incredibly low risk. We have no sense of risk in our society and how to handle it. Like, a spike in the death rate leads to fear amongst the general population. And you can't live your life in fear. And the societies that live in fear the whole time are basically societies that are just going nowhere. They have no future if you're frightened the whole time.
A part of what you're hearing in the discussion here is just, you know, the generational reflection, which is, gosh, I mean, World War II generation compared to the people in charge now and the reaction you're getting from younger people who would have been sort of the parallel to the younger generation that went off to war in World War II. I wonder, I mean, the land of Winston Churchill, I wonder if you're hearing some of those same sort of wistful, nostalgic references to the World War II generation as compared to what England has become.
Well, we had VE Day last week, and that was a reminder. One of the things that I find really strange about, certainly in Britain, is the reaction of young people, because they are effectively immune. Their chances of getting the virus and suffering anything really bad from it are tiny, and yet they are some of the most fervent lockdowners. I can't explain it. I can't rationalize it. But they have become gripped with fear. And if young people are gripped with fear, that's a problem in itself. And I think it's partly because we have the misfortune to have a prime minister who not only contracted the virus, became very seriously ill from it. And Boris Johnson's 55. And then he was on a ventilator and nearly died. And that has accentuated the sort of narrative of fear that pervades British society. There isn't the get up and go. There's been no spontaneous demonstrations that you've had in Illinois and other parts of the United States and in Michigan, notably. of people saying this is too much, this is an infringement of basic freedom. There's another point that I find really interesting in all this, if you like, an ideological point, that the left and the, if you like, the mainstreams all say that the libertarians and conservatives don't believe in society, they're just purely for the atomistic individual and the selfish gene and so forth. Actually, it's the libertarians, it's the conservatives who want people to be allowed to go out into society because that's where we belong. And this inhumane locking up of people in tiny little units and separating them, which the collectivists and the left are now inflicting and imposing on people, is profoundly antisocial and anti the individual.
Well, right. I mean, we're if we're not there, we're nearing the Orwellian territory of freedom is slavery. I mean, that's essentially the argument I'm hearing from the left.
Yes, that's right. And this, and as you pointed out, this idea that work, there is a dignity to work, there is a dignity to labor, which the left have completely stripped away, and they just feel that people should get. They should just get money for nothing. Absolutely, and there is no, and that is why I think Larry Summers, if you'd like, in the big picture, Larry Summers is onto something in saying that the pandemic could well lead to an Asian century, because they don't believe that. They don't think that money grows. You just get money for just sitting on your, you know, sitting at home, and that will be the future. I think there is, and I think, you know, to be political about this, I think what November 2020 will be about when you guys go vote, that will be the decision point, whether America is going to go join the declinists across the Atlantic or pick herself up and say, we have a future, our best days are yet to come.
He is Rupert Dhariwal, strategy consultant and policy analyst, former special advisor to the UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer, author of The Age of Global Warming, A History and Green Tyranny, Exposing the Totalitarian Roots of the Climate Industrial Complex. Rupert Dhariwal, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
With the Sultans, with the Sultans of Swing.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. The Cheesehead State, I don't think it's technically, I think it's technically called the Badger State, but I prefer the Cheesehead State, giving hope to the land of Lincoln, at least the state Supreme Court is, by shutting down Governor Tony Evers's shutdown order this week in a 4-3 decision, which has been, you know, radically politicized, as everything is these days, even COVID-19 related. But the decision from the majority, the holding, pretty straightforward, which is basically, hey, we have three co-equal branches of government, governor and public health director, and the legislative branch gets to exercise the power it has been constitutionally conferred. That is what is at stake here. I don't really understand the controversy exactly, other than there's a disagreement over the policy. And so the governor has taken the position that the way to avoid a disagreement with the legislature on a particular policy is to ignore the legislator and just act as the legislature. This action will inevitably lead to more sickness and death. The court will have blood on their hands, and the people of Wisconsin will not forget. That was the attorney who represented Evers commenting on the decision. The predicate to the decision was this questioning by Justice Rebecca Bradley. Isn't the very definition of tyranny for one person to order people to be imprisoned for going to work, among other ordinarily lawful activities? Also, in the ruling for the majority, the justice who penned the opinion just basically said, you know, if it's a fire, you've got to act immediately. If it's a pandemic that afflicts the state for month after month, then you can act immediately under emergency powers, but then you have to seek to enlist the legislature for legislative approval. I mean, this is like a fifth grade civics class. Why is this in controversy? It's only in controversy because you have politicians like Evers and Pritzker and others believing that they are where the law begins and ends. And thankfully, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said they're not. If only we had a co-equal branch in Illinois that would be so enlightened. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Will Flanders, He is the research director at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Will, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
So how are cheeseheads reacting to the verdict?
Yeah, so I think there's a high level of satisfaction in general. Of course, you have, you know, just like any other state, we have division, and we have some at the county level that are implementing similar ordinances to the Safer at Home order. So that's kind of where things have gone now. The counties association told counties, actually, you're not going to be able to keep these in place. They're going to be declared illegal as well. So some counties like Kenosha, right across the border there, has backed off. Some counties are keeping them in place, and no doubt we'll be back in court again to see if these things can pass muster of the Constitution.
It was sort of a stunning decision in the first place, based on the caseload that Wisconsin was experiencing at the end of last month, for Governor Evers to arbitrarily extend the shelter-in-place order to May 26th. And, you know, forget it, just setting aside the legislature for a second, there is this concept of consent of the governed. You know, Mike DeWine, the governor of Ohio, has been a good example of somebody who's got some sensitivity to that. So reversing policies he was going to enact because he wasn't receiving consent of the governed, popular consent, and in a separate and distinct from legislative consent. And it seems like Evers just got out over his skis with respect to where Wisconsin residents were.
I think that's right. I think he sort of followed the national Democrats around the country in sort of implementing some of these things. You know, if you look back during the first month, during the initial Safer at Home order, there wasn't a great deal of opposition. You know, on both sides, we didn't really know where we stood. We didn't know the level of danger this virus posed. And there wasn't a lot of folks out there saying this shouldn't be in place. But a lot of us, you know, including some of the lawyers at my own place where we were filed an amicus brief in this case, this is unconstitutional, right? You can't just extend these things. You've exceeded your limited emergency powers here. And that's why we filed the amicus brief. That's why the legislature sued. So there was goodwill at first, but that was sort of burned away with the extension that, as you say, a lot of folks would say wasn't necessary.
I wanted to move to this survey that you did there at Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty about families' experience with K-12 education in this time. I rope in Brendan O'Neill's piece in Spiked Online talking about working people in England. The naivete of believing that halting economic life is in any way good for working people is staggering. The lockdown most severely affects working class people who need to leave their homes to earn a living, and its global consequences will be most severely felt by the world's lowest paid workers. Well, to some extent, this is applicable here, just on different measurements, but the same dynamic. And you find that in your survey about the experience that Wisconsin families are having with K-12 education in these times, that those on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum are getting hit the hardest.
That's right. In our survey, we did a survey of 400 Wisconsin parents 2 weeks ago. So we didn't capture the newest changes, but sort of the environment as it still is in Illinois and as it was in Wisconsin until a couple days ago. But what we found is that a lot of families are having to actually spend money on educational resources, you know, whether it be for computers and tablets or just supplemental, you know, materials, tutoring online. And some of those expenses are quite large. You know, 10% of the respondents in our poll said they've had to spend more than $500. So this suggests, you know, folks that are going out and having to buy computers. But the most concerning thing was that the lowest income respondents, those that made under $20,000 in household income a year, were the most likely to say they've had to spend money. So those with the least ability to spend are having to spend the most under this new situation that we're in K-12.
And in big districts, like the Milwaukee School District, there's a sizable percentage of families that are reporting their children are, through distance learning, are being taught the same material that has already been covered. I mean, there's no new learning going on.
That's right. There were a couple concerning things here. We asked how many hours are you spending on education a week, and the second most common answer, about 40% of respondents, was 1 to 10 hours. So when you compare that to how much learning goes, you know, into a regular school day, you know, you have 30 hours a week or more in the classroom. That's concerning. You know, we may not expect the same amount of learning time, particularly as you mentioned, with families having to divide, their work environment at home and with their child's education. But 1 to 10 hours does call into question the extent to which kids are going to be prepared to move on to next year if their learning is that little. And we also asked, are you covering new material, old material, or some combination of both? About 17% of respondents said that they're only covering old material, And this was more prevalent in Milwaukee, as they've really sort of said in some of these districts, we're just going to review, we're not going to do anything new, and we'll go back next year. But that's going to put these kids way behind in districts where they're already behind compared to the other areas of the state.
You should maybe in the next survey you do ask if people believe that the teachers and administrators' salaries should be held back permanently to their previous salaries and benefit packages going forward. How about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I mean, the reality is that, you know, we see that folks are having to spend money, and we see that education is happening in the home environment. School district buildings are not open. There has to be some savings there, right? It may not be a total saving. They're still paying staff. But some of that money, why can't it go back to the parents and families? Why can't we create an education savings account, at least in the very short term, so that families have that resource that otherwise is sort of being wasted on an empty school building to use for things that would help their child keep up and continue to be educated? And we're big supporters of ESAs in general, and particularly in this instance, I think there's a good cause to advocate for that, both in Wisconsin and around the country.
He is Will Flanders, Research Director at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Will, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Don't let governors fool you about reopening. That's the message that Yanir Bar-Yam provides in a piece was posted on CNN. He is reputedly an expert on pandemics and other complex systems. He's the president of New England Complex Systems Institute. He advises the WHO Global Outbreak and Alert Response Network on Ebola eradication. And he's spearheading the effort of more than 4,000 volunteers working to stop the COVID-19 outbreak at endcoronavirus.org. Okay. Citizens should know that reopening states is very unlikely to restore economic well-being. In fact, prematurely reopening would likely cause the disease to escalate and lead to prolonged economic hardship. Every public interaction will endanger our health, causing sickness and death, and further burdening our healthcare system. Other countries could forbid their citizens from visiting the United States, and Americans could be barred from much of the world. Even trade may be viewed as an unacceptable risk. Based on the research I've conducted, Mr. Bar-Yam concludes, I believe if we would take a more aggressive approach now and keep towns and cities locked down, we can defeat COVID-19 in 4 to 6 weeks. Sounds like something we heard back in March from folks like Yanir Bar-Yam. In fact, it was in March. He called for the U.S. to impose a strict 5-week national lockdown with internal and external travel restrictions to bring us near zero infections. He says the lockdowns that happened really by the third and fourth weeks of March were too little too late. We must understand the coronavirus is very deadly. We must understand that almost all reopening states from California to Pennsylvania currently have a critical mass of new cases of existing infections that could see new outbreaks in the coming days and weeks. And thirdly, we must understand without extreme preventative measures, we've seen how coronavirus infections doubled every 2 to 3 days at one point in different areas. And that could happen again, is essentially the point. That's one perspective from the perspective of a reputed expert on infectious disease. Let's get another one. That's what we try to do here, is bump perspectives against one another, see what is most supported by the evidence and the logic. To help us do that, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Trost, who's an associate director of the Institute for the Study of Free Enterprise at Oklahoma State University. And he's penned a very compelling piece on a risk management, detailing a risk management approach to defeating the virus. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Certainly.
From my read of your piece and my read of that piece I was referencing from Mr. Bar-Yam, there are very different conclusions being drawn about the next steps. So let's go through yours, and maybe we bump them up against Mr. Bar-Yam's. You start by sort of distinguishing between true uncertainty and risk as the basis for your framework for for investigation and then recommendation. So just, why don't we just start there? True uncertainty versus risk and where we are on that continuum.
Yeah, so Professor Frank Knight was an economist at the University of Chicago in the 1920s, and he wrote a book called Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit, where he identified the differences between risk and what he called true uncertainty. And the difference is the existence of relevant prior cases. So risk is that situation where you can assign a probability to a future event based on something you know about similar cases that have occurred in the past. And Knight said when we're facing true uncertainty, it's the situation where we don't have that tie-in to relevant prior cases. And when we look at this pandemic, we are in the realm of true uncertainty when we rely on things like development of a vaccine, because we've never in human history developed a successful vaccine against a human coronavirus. And so what I've done is looked at the things that are on the risk side of the spectrum rather than the uncertainty side of the spectrum.
Let's hold there, the risk side of the spectrum versus the uncertainty side of the spectrum. I want to pick it up right there when we return with Steve Trost, who is an associate director of the Institute for the Study of Free Enterprise at Oklahoma State University. More with Steve Trost right after this.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're speaking with Steve Trost. He's the Associate Director of the Institute for the Study of Free Enterprise at Oklahoma State University. He has a bachelor's in engineering from MIT, a master's and PhD in engineering from Oklahoma State University, and a PhD in entrepreneurship from Oklahoma State University. And we were where we left off was a discussion of the approach that Steve took in analyzing a strategy for defeating COVID-19 rooted in risk management, but risk management focused on assessing actual risk versus true uncertainty. So, Steve, pick it up there.
So, yeah, so my analysis really relies upon two assumptions that are solidly in the risk category. The first assumption is that this virus affects different people differently. The data that we have are age differentiated. So we have data that show that if you're over 70 years old, your likelihood of dying from catching the virus is much, much higher, about 1,000 times higher than if you're in your teens or 20s. Secondly, the second assumption is that those who are exposed to the disease and recover will have some level of immunity, which that is the fundamental basis of the assumption that a vaccine can actually be developed. And that is what we observe with existing human coronaviruses. So, you know, there are two common human coronaviruses that are widely spread throughout society that cause common cold on a seasonal basis. So we know that there is immunity and even cross immunity between those viruses. So this is not something that is in the realm of uncertainty. You know, this is something that we understand, the way that immunity is developed based on exposure to viruses.
Well, and just to stop you for a second too, it's important that you make the point, even though this has been made ad nauseum in the public sphere, about what we understand about how the universe, how the virus treats different universes differently, because you have statements from public health professionals like Yanir Bar-Yam, whose piece I was reading before, opposing the reopenings. We must understand the coronavirus is very deadly. it's just a generic statement. Yes, it is very deadly, but only within certain cohorts. And you make the additional point, and there's even more nuance than age. From your piece, I recall, a 80-year-old who is in good health and has no underlying condition like obesity or diabetes or a heart condition is better positioned to fight off the virus than a 60-year-old with a comorbidity. So the combination of age and comorbidities makes this really a much more specific than, say, influenza A or B. And that's sort of lost in some of the arguments that seem to be advanced by people like Mr. Bar-Yam.
That's correct. And the ultimate focus of my analysis is on the danger of uniform approach to social distancing. If we treat everybody the same, in other words, if we apply social distancing guidelines uniformly across the entire population, what that means is that the exposure is going to be uniform across the population, which means that those who are at greater risk have the same chance of getting an infection, but they have a much greater chance of dying from that infection. So my point is, we know that this virus treats different people differently. So what we really need from a risk management standpoint is we need a system that protects those that are at greatest risk so that we have an uneven exposure to the virus, so that we actually have what I refer to as a targeted exposure, where we're basically setting things up so that those who are at very low risk have a much higher probability of getting infected with the virus because their chances of serious complications is much less.
And this is sort of a de facto herd immunity thinking behind the approach that should be employed.
Well, and vaccine is a herd immunity approach as well.
Right. Yes. Okay.
The difference is with the vaccine, you know, we're introducing a hopefully harmless portion of the RNA of the virus in order to elicit an immune response without symptoms. Now, we know that with this virus, that the vast majority of the very healthy people who are exposed to it are asymptomatic. They actually exhibit no symptoms, which is exactly what you want from a vaccine, right? Your ideal vaccine, there's no symptoms, but there's an immune response. And then you build herd immunity through that natural process of the human body producing antibodies as a result of the immune response. So really, my approach is, you could think of it as a natural vaccine, right? You know, we want to allow those people who are at very low risk of serious complications to go ahead and live life the way they normally would, and just allow the virus to do its thing with those individuals while we are aggressively protecting the high-risk individuals.
Yeah, I mean,
and
this,
the point of this is, yeah, we can aggressively protect high-risk individuals for a short period. We can't do it for, you know, 12 to 18 months as well as we can do it for, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. And this virus is so prolific that it would probably only take, you know, 6 to 8 weeks of normal circulation in the population to get us, you know, fairly close to that population immunity.
Well, it makes sense, the symmetry of it, right? It's the idea that virus treats different people differently, so should we.
Exactly.
Particularly against the backdrop of as you point out, two things we've never done before. You already made mention an effective vaccine for a class of human coronaviruses, and two, this doing the approach that Mr. Bar-Yam advocated in the piece I referenced earlier, you know, shut down to buy more time. You're still doing this predicated on developing a vaccine faster than we've ever developed any vaccine for anything. So in terms of sort of what the logical landing point would be, what you're suggesting seems to be much more rooted in reality.
Yeah, I mean, the New York Times said, you know, that the normal approach to developing a vaccine will take 16 years. They said we could potentially accelerate it to 15 months, but that's if everything just goes perfectly with a process that we've never followed before. We haven't followed that accelerated vaccine development process before. And then we're coupling that with trying to develop a vaccine for a human coronavirus, when we've never developed a vaccine for that type of virus before.
Hmm. He is Steve Trost, Associate Director of the Institute for the Study of Free Enterprise at Oklahoma State University. Check out his piece that details his risk management approach to defeating the virus, which I'll tweet out at Dan Prof Show. Steve Trost, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cheeseburger in paradise. Medium rare with mustard be nice.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show, and it's been an eventful week with respect to the prosecution of General Michael Flynn, the Russian collusion investigation that was, the special prosecutor's pursuit of Russian collusion that was not, or at least turned out to be no there there, of course, and the look forward to the Durham report and the competing accusations, as we discussed with Brett Baer, of who weaponized the government to inflict damage on which political opponents. Who better to memorialize all of this in prose, as we try to wrap our minds around it, than the Dan Prof Show Poet Laureate R.A. Droit. He inveighs. Projection is the term the learned use when malefactors act and say jacuge to tar the reputation of their foes by blaming them for misdeeds of their own. Those thirsty for examples will be slaked by learning that the dossier was faked. Collusion with the Russians was their deed to claim that Trump and Putin were in league. The dossier of Steele was, at its core, just Russian unsourced fiction and no more. But Comey, not too needful of a nudge, was pleased to show it to a FISA judge in hopes the FISA court would be outraged and signed the warrant aimed at Carter Page. Sans dossier, no warrant would be had, and so the FBI was all too glad to swear it valid to the FISA court, although they knew it was a flawed report. And Rodham's role as Steele's patroness was missing from what Comey would attest. In short, this application had the cred of life insurance apps from hospice beds. Well done, R.A. Droit. Very good. Not too many shows have a poet laureate, particularly one who is keen to offer par excellence in terms of prose. So thank you very much for that. And I also want to offer a suggestion for some weekend viewing in addition to the weekend consideration of that poem. Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, is my recommendation. Documentary presenting convincing evidence that the biblical account of the Exodus is true. It is the vision of independent filmmaker Tim Mahoney, who journeyed to Egypt, Israel, and throughout the world to search for answers to the very important question, did the stories like Exodus, as written in the Bible, really happen? Right now, you can watch Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, at home, along with the other movies in the series at patternsofevidence.com. The other movies in the series, The Moses Controversy, as well as the Red Sea Miracle. Watch all three. Watch them at Patterns of Evidence and at patternsofevidence.com. Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, and all the two others in the series can be viewed at patternsofevidence.com. Thank you for joining us all week and on this installment of the Dan Prof Show. Have a great weekend. Safe, secure, sane, hopefully increasingly open, and we'll catch you next week.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.